Session number 6191, real one.
Jacob, real one. Srian, firstly, I'd like to ask you about the origins of the Central War Room, and in particular, whether you personally had any part in preparing the Central War Room.
I had no part in preparing the Central War Room. I arrived in the Cabinet Office, or the CID, it was the Office of the Committee of Imperial Defence, in fact, in those days, just after the Munich crisis. And I think work had already begun on it all, but I didn't know anything about it. The man who was primarily responsible for organizing it was Hollis, who, on behalf of General Ismay, used to run our office and general action. So I think he would have been very much to the fore in this, and I think it was he who arranged for the Royal Marines to man it.
When did you first become aware of the existence of the Central War Room?
I don't think I became aware of it very early, because I worked all the time, as we all did before the war, in Richmond Terrace. And we did know that something was being prepared over in Great George Street, but we didn't... I did once go and see it, I know that, but I can't remember when it was, before we occupied it, so that one would know one's whereabout and how to get in and out and so on. And it only came into operation, really, just before the outbreak of war.
When you did see it, did you get the impression that it had been set up as a temporary measure?
No, I don't think I did. I thought it was there to stay, because we moved out of Richmond Terrace, we moved into Great George Street, and as far as I knew, that was it. I knew there was also, of course, there had been all the planning going on before the war about the possible move of the government out of London. But I was only partially involved in that, and I didn't really do much about it. But I knew that there were places prepared in the West Country, but I never went to any of them.
Have you any idea why the Cabinet decided not to move to the West Country?
I think because the threat didn't seem to be sufficient to make them. I mean, it was thought, you see, that there might be such tremendous damage in London that communications and so on wouldn't work, and one would have to have somewhere as a standby. And these standbys were all prepared, but were never used.
What was the state of mind of the Cabinet and the central organs in August 1939 in regard to the possibility of air attack?
Well, it had always been assumed, on the advice of the Air Ministry, that the outbreak of war would be marked by a very heavy air attack on London. So much so that the hospitals were all to be cleared of patients, and affairs were to be arranged so that things could continue under a very heavy air attack. I forget how many casualties it was thought there would be, but it was a very large number. I remember very well, just before the actual outbreak of war, I think it must have been the last day of August or thereabouts, that the chiefs of staff were asked to advise the government on the best time of day for issuing an ultimatum to the Germans, it being assumed that within 6 hours of the ultimatum there would be a heavy air attack on London. And was it best for this to arrive while people were at work, or after they got home to their houses, or what? And there was a long discussion about this, and I forget what conclusion we came to, but of course in the end it was quite academic, because the issue of an ultimatum was decided by other considerations. The moment came when you had to issue it, And so there it was. But I think we had also, everybody had a very greatly exaggerated idea of the effect of Big Air Raid. You see, we knew there had been things in Spain and that sort of thing, but nobody quite knew what, if you sent over 500 bombers or something, what the result would be. And it was, generally speaking, it was greatly an exaggerated impression. Was, I mean, as the thing showed in the end, London's so enormous that you could stand a very big weight of bombing without being ruined. But still, that was the general feeling.
But even so, the cabinet decided to stay in London despite this threat of air attack.
Yes. Whether or not... I think they always felt that they'd have to wait and see before moving. And, of course, the children were all evacuated. But as the Germans were so busy attacking the Poles, it probably was thought that they couldn't have enough to spare to make the sort of heavy attack on London that had previously been envisaged. And that may have influenced them to stay where they were and see what happened.
If I can move on now to talk about the Cabinet War Room in use. It does appear that the Cabinet made no use whatsoever of the War Room in 1939. Is this the case?
I can't remember the Cabinet meeting down there. I very well remember the first meeting of the War Cabinet, and that was in Number 10, the normal way, in the daytime. And they went on meeting in Number 10 continuously. There was no bombing developed and there was no point in moving. The chiefs of staff used to meet in the war room, and that was quite sensible because they'd got to leave their offices anyway to meet, and they might just as well meet there as upstairs. But they did. They met down below, certainly for quite a long time in the early part of the war. I can't remember how long it went on for, but it came to an end, of course, because for all the rest of the war, they met in the mornings in Great George Street.
What about other committees? Did they meet in the war room?
None that I was responsible for, except once the Blitz started, then we did have meetings of the Defence Committee I think the Cabinet. Any committee that met at night. Now, the ordinary committees went on meeting in the daytime, carried on upstairs just the same.
What do you mean by upstairs? Do you mean on the ground floor of the new public offices?
Well, in Great George Street, do you call them the new public offices? We didn't. We call them George Street.
Yeah.
But they used to meet in one of the conference rooms in that building, and there were conference rooms on different floors, but generally speaking they were on the second or first or second floor, and that's where we used to meet.
Did Mr. Chamberlain ever use the Cabinet War Room?
Not that I'm aware of.
But Mr. Churchill did.
Well, he did again just to some extent after the Blitz started. He'd have his evening meetings in the war room, but he still met in the daytime in Number 10. He had his flat prepared down there, very rarely, if ever, used. He used to have the telephone there from which he could speak to the president across the Atlantic, and he used to every now and then make a broadcast from there.
Do you happen to know when the transatlantic telephone was actually installed?
No, I can't remember. But, no, I can't remember at all, but I think it was probably after they came into the war.
And what room did the Prime Minister use for his broadcasts?
Well, there was a little cubbyhole there between his flat and the war room where there was installed the necessary apparatus. And somebody came there and he went in and made his telephone call and came out again, or his broadcast.
Now, the Cabinet Office moved into the new public offices in December 1940. Do you happen to know why they moved into new public offices?
I think because for a long time it had been felt that Richmond Terrace was much too dangerous. It was a flimsy building. The basements had been strengthened with timber baulks and that sort of thing. And I remember going down there right at the beginning of the war and I spent one or two nights there, I think, because there were some false alarms, you know, of air raids. But once it was seen that there weren't going to be any air raids and so on, we carried on. But meanwhile, they completed the preparation of the war room. And we moved over there, and it's not only the war room, that probably had been completed already. It was the accommodation we were going to occupy upstairs on the second floor and first floor. And I suppose that took a bit of time to do, because you had to move all the people out.
Did you work in the Cabinet War Rooms?
No, only if I attended a meeting. I used to go down there very often in the evening. Even if there was no meeting, I would go down there practically every evening to the map room and see what was going on. Talk to the people running the map room. And then I would go and have supper, perhaps in the mess, or have a drink afterwards. There used to be some very interesting people gathered there after dinner. I remember having a number of chats over a drink with Robert Menzies from Australia. Bruce. I've got the wrong generation. Bruce, who was the Prime Minister of Australia then, and came over. And other people used to drop in there from time to time. Littleton was one. It was quite a nice little place to spend an hour or two after dinner. And I occasionally slept down there, because if I was kept at a late night meeting and was too late to go home, I used to go down there.
What sort of food did they prepare in the mess?
As far as I remember, very nice food. I mean, straightforward, but we had a very good square meal.
Where was it cooked?
I presume down there. I never went into that side of it. We had an administrative officer of the war room, sort of camp commandant, or whatever you like to call him, who was Captain Adams of the Navy. And I suppose he sought all those things. I had nothing to do with it. The Royal Marines served the mess. I presume they did the cooking.
It sounds as though the quality of life in the Cabinet War Room was really quite good.
Not bad. Not at all bad. The air down there, on the whole, was good. I found sleeping in my room there very comfortable and airy and nice. Of course, one didn't want to stay there all day long if one could avoid it, because one liked looking out of the window and getting the fresh air upstairs. But it was perfectly tolerable.
But lots of people preferred to work upstairs if they could.
I think they probably did. And I dare say that the condition of the air varied from one part of the war room to another, because that is, under my experience, that always happens with any system of air conditioning, that it works better in one part of the building than in another.
When you were working with the Cabinet Office, were you aware of conflicts with other departments over the distribution of accommodation in the cabinet war rooms or new public offices?
Thank God I had nothing whatever to do with accommodation. So that I wasn't really aware. I suppose I must have heard from time to time that there were difficulties. Hello? Is that Daisy? Oh, you. I suppose there must have been difficulties from time to time, but I wasn't aware of them at all. It didn't impinge on... again, you see, there was an administrative staff of these things who coped with it all. If decisions had to be made, no doubt they were taken by General Ismay or Colonel Hollis.
Did you become aware of any signs of overcrowding in 1940 when the Home Defence Executive moved into the basement?
Didn't affect the part of the basement that I used. I don't know where they went. I sound very ignorant, but the fact of the matter is that if it didn't impinge on me, I had no responsibilities to them, you see. So I just didn't bother about them, but certainly it didn't affect me in any way.
Or my sounds work. As though if you were in the war rooms, you were so busy doing your own work, you had very little
that's right.
time
well,
to notice.
This was true about the cabinet office as a whole. I think you get on with your own job. And except for meals and little time, perhaps in the evening, one just was at it most of the time, you see.
What time did you normally start in the mornings?
Well, I used to get to the office as a rule. Again, this is very difficult to remember, but I should think about 9 o'clock. I was living, most of the time, when I could get home, I was living in Knightsbridge. And so it was quite easy to get in by bus. And I think I used to get in there about 9, or a little later, not much, but I used to think probably about that. And then, of course, one went on according to what was happening. You might have a meeting. The PM's best favourite time for meetings got later as the war went on to about 10:30 in the evening. So you, in that case, one didn't finish the meeting until after midnight. And then one had to dictate the minutes and see them in typed. And so I didn't get to bed till about 2:30.
Was it a general rule that minutes had to be circulated next morning?
Oh, yes, always. Never waited.
And it was a general rule that the normal routine of business had to be carried on regardless of conditions?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think the reason for this was to provide people with a sense of security?
Security in what way?
A sense of business going ahead as normal, despite the effects of enemy action.
Oh, I never thought of it that way. It certainly went ahead, and one assumes it would. And there was never any delay over these things. And one got used to this wherever one happened to be. I mean, travelling with Winston, for example, going to Moscow or somewhere, one would do minutes in the aeroplane or anything, but everything had to be up to date.
So Mr. Churchill was very keen on keeping things up to the mark.
Well, he was always impatient for anything that he wanted. I mean, if he wanted to see a paper or to see the conclusion, and of course, if they were important conclusions, well, we want his approval before they went out. And quite often one would draft just the conclusion and get him to agree to it before one dictated the rest of the minutes, you see, and then the whole thing went out together. But things didn't get held up ever.
Now, you said that he didn't make very much use of his accommodation under the slab.
I don't think so.
What about other members of the War Cabinet? Did they use the facilities more extensively?
No, I don't think so. It was them nearly all working in their own offices, you see, and presumably they had something down there, I don't know. They only came into the war room to see the map room occasionally, or to see somebody, or to meet.
I I'd like to discuss the security measures at the war room. The first question is, how secure did the inhabitants of the war room feel?
As far as I know, completely so. You see, you had to get in through the Marines, who were on the door. One had a pass, I suppose. I can't remember that either. Must have had. But of course, they got to know you very well. But one didn't think about security at all. One just took it for granted it was absolutely all right.
There was never any consideration of a potential threat from espionage or fifth column activity?
Not to my knowledge, but there may have been in the minds of the people who are responsible for security. I wasn't.
How did the Marines actually check on you? Did they always insist upon the production of papers? Or did
I think they did. As far as I remember, you had to produce your pass. And I have a feeling that there were two lots, one after the other. You went through at the top and then again lower down.
Which entrance did you normally use?
I think there only was one entrance. As far as I was aware, I never went down any other.
Where was this located?
You went in Great Charles Street.
And were the Marines on duty in 1940 the same as those on duty in 1945?
I have no idea. You mean the same men?
Yes.
I can't remember. Certainly, some of the lift men and those sort of messengers and people, they were all the same, upstairs in the cabinet office. Got to know them well. But, you see, you're just going to see through that. I can't tell you that. I have no idea.
Were you at all involved with the preparation of defence plans for the government war room or the building?
No, not at all. In fact, I didn't know there were any. You tell me, I believe, that there was a considerable lot of Home Guard in various places. I knew nothing about that. All I did know was that there was a certain amount of organisation of fire watching. But the rest, I don't know. I have no idea. That must have been, again, organised by... I think that there would have been a body under the Home Forces or somebody of that sort whom we would have been one of the charges, you see. We ourselves didn't do anything about it.
Now I want to talk about the adequacy of defences against bombing. Now, it does appear from the documentary sources that it was eventually decided that the slab that was constructed between 1940 and 1941 was not proof against bombing by armour-piercing bombs. And it also appears that Mr. Churchill believed until the summer of 1940 that the war room had been bomb-proofed. When he found that it hadn't been, he was very angry. Would you have any idea as to how he came to be so misinformed?
No, I can't. It's a funny thing, I can't remember at all. I do remember that I think we always knew that it wasn't really bomb-proof. There was a lot of building above, of course. The bomb got to come through first. But I think we knew that, and then I think it was determined that they must do something better than this, because the bombs were getting bigger. And after all, the bombs we were planning were getting bigger. The original small bombs that they dropped wouldn't have bothered anybody very much. But this wasn't true as time went on. And so they had to do something much more... you tell me, when we were talking just now, that I had written something about this. Well, I have no recollection of this at all. But I do remember the work being done. But it went on all the time, and they were putting steel, of course, in the courtyards and so on. I could see it out of the window quite easily. But it didn't have any impact on my work. I just went on.
Didn't cause any inconvenience?
Not that I remember.
The slab was first condemned as being unsafe, as far as I can remember, by a Mr. Winifrith.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember him?
Yes, very well. He's still alive. Oh. You get hold of him. He was private secretary to Bridges.
Did he also act as establishment's officer to the...
He may well have done. The establishment officer was Lawrence Burgess, but he's been dead many years now. And Winifred would certainly be worth talking to on the subject. I'm practically sure he's still alive. I don't remember seeing him that he's dead. He ended up as PUS for the Ministry of Agriculture. Very good fellow.
So you don't remember at any stage suddenly feeling that you were less secure than you had felt before?
No. We didn't bother about it very much. I'm afraid we took all these things very reasonably lightheartedly, you know, because we just got on with our work. And of course, if one was responsible for something, that would be different.
Did you notice any sudden change in the general mood in the Cabinet Office when the crossbow attack started?
Well, we'd known it was coming, of course, all along. And it was just a question of when. And there had been a lot of argument about the photographs of Penimunda, what they really meant. There were a series of meetings held, which I used to refer to as Elijah and the Prophets of Baal, because Elijah was Lindemann, the prof, and the Prophets of Baal were the engineers and rocket experts brought in to look at the evidence and say what was coming. And they said, well, we're going to have large rockets with 10-ton warheads. That's what's lying on the ground at Penimunda. And the prof said, not at all, it's nothing of the kind. We're going to have pilotless aircraft. And anyway, a rocket with a 10-ton warhead is absurd. So I remember going to him after one evening. I said, why do you say that this is absurd, you see? And he said, well, he said, if you came to me and said you had a man in your company who was 10 feet tall, I wouldn't believe you. If you said he was 7 feet tall, I would. It's so out of scale with anything possible that it must be wrong.